Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne, and if you're watching me right now on screen, if you're seeing my face, then you already know this. But if you're listening on an audio-only platform, then I'm happy to tell you that the Appleseed, after more than a decade of audio storytelling, is now a video experience, too. You'll always still be able to hear the podcast wherever you like to listen. But if you want to see these great storytellers telling their tales, now you can. Search for us on YouTube or Spotify or at byuradio.org. to see what you've been hearing. Now, on to some great stories. First up, a story from the Grammy-winning storyteller Bill Harley. It's a story about the mystery of what might be behind a particular forbidden door at his elementary school. Here's Bill, recorded live in the Appleseed studio, with a story called The Teacher's Lounge.
By the time I'd been halfway through second grade at Delaware Trail Elementary School in Indianapolis, Indiana, I had been in every room at Delaware Trail Elementary School except for one. I had been in all the classrooms because I was Mrs. Elliott's little messenger. I'll talk about that in a little while. I had been to the office once on a field trip. I had been to the custodian's office and seen the boiler. I'd been to the nurse's office. I'd even been in the girls' bathroom once on a dare. And there was only one room I had not been in, and neither had any of my friends. And I know some of you have not been in that room either, the teacher's lounge. The teacher's lounge. All the other doors at Delaware Trail Elementary School had these little narrow windows so you could look in and see what was going on. Not the teacher's lounge. No, the teacher's lounge, it was a solid oaken door, and it was always shut. And we would walk by in second grade, and we would look up at the door, and we would look at the sign at the door. We would try to make sense out of it. You know, it said teacher's lounge, staff only. But back there as kids, you know, we didn't know all those words, and we would guess at that. You know, we always say we're teaching children, but mostly children learn by guessing. And that's what we do. We look up there at teachers. We recognize that word. Teachers, teachers, lawang, lawangi, 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 lawing, lounge, 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 lounge. You guys, it's a lounge. It's a lounge. My dad had a lounge chair. He would sit on the lounge chair in the summer, and he would drink beer. Oh! Is that what they're doing in there? No wonder they're always going in there. But the other words are even more confusing. English is such a confusing language. It borrows from all over, like staff only. Staff, what does that mean? Well, I did go to Sunday school. My parents sent me there, and I wasn't great at Sunday school, but it seemed to me that there was this guy named Moses, and he had a staff, and it was a big stick. The teachers have sticks. They have big sticks in there. They're going to beat us. I knew it. Or this kid got sick in first grade, and he had to go home in the middle of the day, and the teacher said, oh, it's so sad. He had a staph infection. And I thought, oh, right, staff. Like the teacher's always saying, we're sick of this. They go in there, blah, throw up and come out again. They've all got staph infections, right? Or I had just started to take piano lessons. We had this piano and I was playing fine all by myself. And then they made me take piano lessons and suddenly it was much more difficult. And I had, because you had to learn these little squiggles up on the page. They said, the music's up here. I said, no, it's down here on the piano. And I had to learn to read the musical staff, and that was hard. I thought the teachers never learned to read music, so they go to staff only. That's all they work on. Or this was during one of our wars, you know, that we were having. Everybody seems to always be having wars, and my dad would watch the news, and the generals would come on, and they would talk about their war, and they were called the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I thought, that's it. The teachers go into that room, and they put on army uniforms, and they practice ordering people around. That's why they're so good at it. But none of us knew till one day in second grade. That day in second grade, Mrs. Elliott, my teacher, was not
the playground monitor, and it was a third grade teacher, and we were always afraid of the teachers in the grade above because the teachers would always say, oh, boys and girls, if you do that next year, they'll break your arms. You know, whatever grade you're in next year, they'll rip your lungs out, right? And it was a third grade teacher that was the playground monitor, and she led us back into the classroom, and Mrs. Elliott wasn't there. And she said, boys and girls, Mrs. Elliott will be back in a minute. I'm going to go across the hall. I'm going to leave my door open so I can hear you. Let's surprise Mrs. Elliott with how quiet we can be. And then she turned the lights off to tame the wild animals, because that's a classroom management technique. And she left, and we were quiet for a long time, like 45 seconds. Which is a long time in the life of a second grader. And then from over by the window, by a desk, and by the window, we hear this. We turned and looked, and it was Warren. Warren Brennan, who never cried. His head was on his desk. His arms were covering his head, and his body was going up and down. We said, Warren, what is it? Warren, what is it? And he raised his head, and there were tears coming down his cheek, and the dust in the playground was making little mud rivers down the side of his face. We said, what is it? And he held out his hand. He said, I cut my hand. He cut his hand on some piece of playground equipment that didn't meet the safety specifications, you know? And when he first cut his hand, it wasn't a gash. It was just a slice, right? And he wiped it off, and then it came back. And he wiped it off again, and he wiped it off. Oh, yeah, you lick your hand when you're cut, too. I've seen you do it. You know? And when he first cut his hand, he looked around for Mrs. Elliott, but she wasn't there. There was just a third grade teacher, and if he showed it to her, she'd just say, too bad. I was just going to cut it off next year anyway. So even though it was still bleeding, he waited until he got back in the classroom, but Mrs. Elliott wasn't there, and now it had been a minute and a half. It was still bleeding. Now, we all got up out of our seats because there was this unspoken rule we knew in our classroom is when you see blood, you can get out of your seat. So we all did it. We surrounded him, this kind of amoeba of concern. We engulfed him. He said, let's see it, Warren. And I turned to Mike, because Mike's dad was a doctor. I said, what do you think, Mike? He said, well, my dad says if a kid loses 2 pints of blood, he dies. Someone said, you're not going to die, but you might as well die because you're going to have 100 stitches. I don't want stitches. We were trying to offer medical advice, but nothing seemed to be working. Now, we knew what needed to happen. You do, too. When you get hurt in school, you go to the nurse's office, but not in second grade by yourself. It's like 7 miles down there. You're not supposed to be in the hall without permission. We were still trying to follow the rules, right? Someone had to give him permission. So he would go down and come back with one of the three things that the nurse was trained to dispense, the cough drop, an ice cube, or a Band-Aid. And if you were going to die, you just might hit the trifecta and get all three. But there was no one there to give permission, and we were trying to follow the rules, but there was no one. We hadn't realized, actually, the rules don't work all that well. But someone had to go get Mrs. Elliott so she could come back and send him down to the nurse's office. But who was going to go? Well, right away, we knew who should go. We knew Emily Hornacker should go because she was Emily Hornacker and we weren't. Emily always did everything right. She always got 100s. She always got A's. She always knew the answer. Whatever she did was right. We said, Emily, go. Emily, go. And she said, no. We said, you have to go. No, we can't. Why not? Because you're not supposed to be in the hall without permission, she said. But there's no one to give permission. She said, we'll have to wait. We said, Warren's dying. She said, I'm sorry, Warren. You'll just have to wait. And we were all putting this incredible peer pressure on her. And then someone said, hey, what if someone goes with you? And she hesitated for a moment, considering, and that was when she looked at me. Because if someone was going to be in the hallway, why not Bill? He spent half the day in the hallway anyway. Now, I'm not saying I was a bad student. I was a good student. I always did everything I was supposed to do. It's just after I was done with it, I did a lot more. I could not stay in my seat. As soon as I get to school, I'm 5 minutes into school in the class, I get up and my body would say, just run around. I'd say, okay, I'd run around. And Mrs. Elliott would say, what are you doing, Bill? I said, I don't know. She said, would you sit down? I said, yes, I sat down because I did what I was told. And then 5 minutes later, I would be up again. She'd say, what are you doing? I'd say, I don't know. She'd say, sit down. I would sit down. I did as I was told. And after about 2 weeks, Mrs. Elliott realized without a major brain operation, I was not going to change. And that was when I became her little messenger. Every time she had a message to deliver, and sometimes when she didn't, she would just send me out in the hallway. She'd say, Bill, go down to the fourth and fifth grade wing and come back around 2:30, okay? Or once she gave me this piece of paper, it was folded overhead, piece of tape on it. She said, take this down to Miss Considine in fourth grade. So I was like, okay. I take it down there, and I couldn't help it. Before I got the door, I just undid the tape, and I opened up the message, and it said, send him somewhere else. So I knew. So if someone is going to be there, you know, and I was like, you might think that's mean, but no, man. I mean, I knew I was special. I was trusted, and children love being in the hallway when everybody else is in class. It's this incredible sense of freedom. So they said, Bill will go. And Emily wasn't sure. They said, come on. And and Warren said, and Mike said, he's lost a pint. And she said, all right. We head out the door, and I start running down the hallway, and Emily says, no running. I said, why? You might trip and hurt yourself. I said, Emily, you sound like you're 46 years old already. And I'm walking in a stiff-legged fashion. She said, there's a door, the classroom door open over there. And I stopped, and I looked in the classroom. Like, hi, Ms. Beeman. Oh, hi, Bill. Emily says, you know her? I said, yeah. I say hi to her every day. We get to the kindergarten wing. She said, all the doors are open. They'll see us. I said, Emily. They're kindergarten teachers. They can't kill us anymore. We got to the office. She said, there's a lot of adults there. I said, pretend like you're going to the library and you scoot by. She said, you do that? I said, every day. Finally, we got to the door. We looked up. Teacher's lounge. Staff only. We just wish they would open the door. We were afraid to touch it. And we heard somebody laughing. I looked it up at Emily. She was bigger than me. All the girls in second grade were bigger than me. I said, I wonder what they're doing in there. She said, they're probably preparing for their next class. I said, yeah, it does sound like an evil laugh. Now we're getting nervous, right? Like, what are you doing in the hallway? Trying to save our classmates' life? That's not good enough. And Emily said, knock on the door. I said, what? She said, knock on the door. She's so bossy. Boom, boom, boom. We heard more laughter. Were they laughing at us? Boom, 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 boom. Boom, boom. Knock more. Boom, boom. Help! Boom. Warren's dying! Boom. There's blood everywhere! They were getting nervous, like, what are we going to do? And Emily looked at me. She said, open the door. I said, what? She said, open the door. I said, you open the door. She said, no. I said, why not? She said, because you're not supposed to. I looked up at her and said, Emily, have you ever done anything you're not supposed to do? She said, no, you're not supposed to. I said, well, today is your lucky day. She said, I can't. I said, you have to. She said, I don't think I like you anymore. I said, that's okay. I can live with that. Open the door. And then in that moment, Emily had to decide between what she thought she was supposed to do and what she had to do. And sometimes they are different when everything is saying you need to do this, but you need to stand up for somebody, or you need to give something that has not been asked for before and you don't know what the rules are. Sometimes there's a difference. And Emily knew that. She reached and she grabbed the doorknob. She turned it and we pushed it open. We looked in and I said, wow. And Emily said, oh my goodness. It was like all of the teachers in the school were in there. There were like 15 teachers. Like, we were unguarded. We could have all escaped. And they were standing around these two long tables, and there were balloons hanging from the ceiling, this crepe paper riveting, and there was cake on the table, and it was half eaten, and over by the sink there were two empty half-gallon cartons of ice cream, and one of the teachers I saw was scraping the icing off the top of the cake with her finger and putting it in her mouth, and they were laughing, and there was must have been a fifth grade teacher, a wild teacher, standing on a chair, standing on school furniture. And everybody was applauding and laughing. Now I think, oh, you know, it was her birthday, or she was getting married, or she was pregnant. But back then I thought, whoa, wait till the principal hears about this. And when I said, whoa, and Emily said, oh my goodness, all the faces and turned and looked at us like a coven of witches. We'll suck your blood out now, my pity. And Mrs. Elliott came up to us. She wasn't surprised to see me, you know, big deal, Bill's in the hallway. But she said, Emily, what are you doing here? And Emily said, Warren's dying. He cut his head and you have to come. And there was nobody there to tell you to come. And we needed permission. And they said I had to come. And I didn't want to because we're not supposed to, but I did. I did. I'm sorry. And Mrs. Elliott said, honey, it's okay. It is? Yeah. You go back to class. I'll be right there. And she shut the door on us. And we heard more laughter. And there was nothing to do but turn around and go back. And Emily's wiping her eyes. She doesn't want anyone to see. So she's cried in school. We all cried in school and no one knew anything about it. I said, I can't believe what they do in there. She said, I can't either. We got back to class. What do you think about Warren? I tell the story to kids and go, he died. No, he did not die. The bleeding had stopped. But he was trying to get it started again. Ms. Ellie was right behind us. She sent Warren down, and he came back with a Band-Aid and a cough drop. But here's what I want to tell you. The things that happen to you when you're a kid are very important, even if no one else knows about them, because they make us who we are. A number of years ago, I went back to Indianapolis to do some school shows, and I was setting up my sound system underneath the backboard that I have done thousands and thousands of times. And the kids weren't in the school yet, just the teachers and this woman, she was short, I remember. She came in and she said, Bill? I said, yeah. She said, we're so glad you're here. I said, I'm happy to be here because I grew up around here. She said, I know. My name is Emily. And I was in your second grade class. And this is how memory it is. It all came flooding back. And I said, Emily Hornacker. And she said, that's not my name anymore. And I thought, that is great. And she said, do you have a minute? And I said, yeah. She said, follow me. She led me out the gym, down the hallway, past the office, past the library. We came to this door and it was closed. And it said, teacher's lounge, staff only. She said, come on in. I opened it in. There was a bunch of teachers in there. They said, surprise. And there were balloons and there were bagels and all sorts of things. They said, we're so happy you're here. We decided to have a party. Emily Hornacker had become a teacher, and I knew why she had become a teacher, so she could have a party every day.
That was Bill Harley with Teacher's Lounge. I love hearing Bill's stories about being a kid, and while he and his friends wind up in all kinds of trouble, it's not usually because they're looking for trouble. The kids in Bill's stories have always seemed to me, in fact, to be trying to do things right, trying to get being a kid right. Maybe whether you're a kid or a grown-up, you know the feeling of things going wrong when all you were trying to do was get it right. Well, Bill's story reminded me, strangely, of a memory of my own. And in this memory, I'm about 7 years old, and I've been asked to be the ring bearer in the big church wedding of my Aunt Christine, my aunt's wedding to my Uncle Peter. I'm supposed to wear a little tuxedo, and I'm supposed to carry the rings on a satin pillow up to the front of the church, where they'll be taken by the bride and groom and placed gently upon each other's ring fingers as part of the ceremony. And to get to the front of the church, I'm supposed to walk down the aisle in rhythm with the organ music. And I'm supposed to stand in just the right place. And, Well, even as I'm describing it to you now, it doesn't seem like there was much to that job. But to me, at 7 years old, it seemed complicated, and I wanted to do a good job. But in rehearsal, I kept messing up the rhythm and standing in the wrong place, or my shoelace was undone, and I felt like I was under the glare of 100 eyes, people who, in my mind, were just seeing me mess things up. And I felt like I was going to wreck my Aunt Chris's wedding, and it was a lot. And while not many saw how hard I was working to get things right, my mom did. My mom saw, and my mom pulled me aside at the wedding rehearsal and told me that she saw how hard I was working to get it right. And it made a world of difference to know that. And, well, the wedding went okay. And I hope you have someone in your life who sees how hard you're trying. And I hope they tell you so. And I hope for more. I hope you can be the kind of person who, when you look at the people around you, sees how hard they're working to get it right. And I hope you tell them, because you know it's rough out there, and they could probably use it. And that's where Bill's story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along? Well, we've got another story for you. This one told by the South Carolina storyteller Tim Lowry. It's a story about kids trying to be on their best behavior as their dad gives a sermon as a kind of audition in a new church where he's trying to get the job as the pastor. What could go wrong? Here's Tim Lowry with a story he calls New Pastor.
The year was 1976. Bicentennial celebration for the United States. And my dad, I grew up a preacher's kid. My dad was going to be candidate at Putney Bible Baptist Church. That meant that he was going to visit as a candidate pastor. He was going to preach a model sermon, and then after church, there would be a very serious business meeting and a vote by the membership to see if they wanted to issue an official call to have him be their full-time minister. Since it was 1976, in the bicentennial year, my mom dressed the entire family appropriately. I was wearing white alligator shoes. I had on bright red pants. I had a plaid jacket in red, white, and blue, my white shirt, and I had a bow tie that was so big it framed my entire face. I looked like a 4-foot Lawrence Welk. And then next to me was my sister. She was wearing a bright red dress with anklet socks. My mother had on a very conservative navy blue dress with a bright red kerchief around her neck, and my father was wearing a navy blue suit, but he had a red, white, and blue American flag tie. And as we got into the car to travel across the mountain from where we lived to Putney Bible Baptist Church, I grew up in the state of Kentucky, so everything's across the mountain one way or another where I grew up. When we got ready to go across the mountain, my mom put my sister and I in the back seat, and she said, "Be on your best behavior. We are going to church, and Daddy really needs this job." So we were threatened to be on the very best behavior. When we got to the church, my mom took us in, and we were shown around for just a little brief time. Then it was time for the service to start. And my mom sat with me and my sister, third row, right side. That's always where the pastor's wife sits. Third row, right side. She sat on the aisle. I sat in the pew next to my mom. Next to me was my sister. And next to my sister was her son, Tom Jr. Now, I was 6 years old. My sister was 4 years old, but she was already a mommy. When she was a little girl, you would ask her, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And she always said the same thing, "I want to be a mommy." By the time she was 10, she had 100 children because she was a doll collector. And she had all kinds of dolls. She didn't like Barbie dolls. She liked big, hard rubber baby dolls. So currently, she was the mother of Tom Jr. He was this big doll. He didn't do anything. His hair was painted on. His eyes didn't roll around in his head. He didn't go wet or anything like that. All he did was you could just grab him by the stiff legs and bend him out straight and stand him up, or then you could bend him and sit him down. That's all that he did. And he had a big hole in his right hand because we had accidentally closed his hand in the car door once, and it chopped all of his fingers off. And so she would just put Band-Aids over the holes and say, "Don't make fun of Tom Jr. He's handicapped." So she had Tom Jr. sitting next to her in the pew at Putney Bible Baptist Church, and she was a very good mommy. My dad, being a preacher, he knew the man who ran the local Bible bookstore, and he'd given him a sample New Testament. My dad had the store embossed Tom Jr.'s name in gold down on the front of the Bible, so she had that for Tom Jr. She had a diaper bag. We had a friend who was an obstetrics nurse, and she would give my sister all kinds of samples from the obstetrics unit at the hospital. She had bottles and little diapers for Tom Jr. She would sit there next to Tom Jr., open the Bible for him, point to the passage my dad was preaching from, hold the hymn book for him. And about halfway through my dad's sermon, my sister would poke that doll and say, "I said, be quiet." She was quite the show. Well, on this particular momentous occasion, my dad was preaching away, and I saw my sister bouncing in her seat, and I realized, oh, Tom Jr. has to go to the bathroom. Well, when we had been shown around the facilities just before the service, I noted where the bathrooms were located. It was a little country church, and you went down the aisle. In the back of the church, there was just the tiniest entry area, and in that space, there were 14 stairs that went way down to a basement. Then you walked back the entire length of the basement, where there was a little one-holer tucked away, basically right underneath the pulpit where my daddy was preaching. And my sister looked at me, and I whispered to her where the bathroom was, and she grabbed Tom Jr. by the hand, and just, and not to disturb my mother, she just slipped out the opposite side of the pew and went out the back of the church, and I heard Tom Jr.'s head clunking on every step as she went down the 14 stairs into the basement, and then eventually I heard the door to the bathroom latch. There was a sign over the toilet in that little bathroom that had been hand-printed, and it said, "Do not flush during sermon." Because if you did, all the water rushing through the pipes, everybody knew exactly where you were. Well, she went in there, and I thought everything was taken care of. My sister has always been very independent, and she could handle herself in the bathroom, but she was only 4 years old, and she couldn't finish the paperwork. So all of a sudden, my mother didn't even see her leave. I guess it's mother's intuition. All of a sudden, my mother just turns and looks at me, and one eyebrow went up, and I could translate, that meant, "Where is your sister?" Well, I was the pastor's son, so I just leaned over and quoted her a Bible verse, "All we like sheep have gone astray." My mom stood up because she knew something was about to happen, and she turned around and she started to walk out of the church. Now she's facing pretty much the entire congregation, and from down in the depths of the basement, we hear my sister yell out from underneath the pulpit, "Mommy, come wipe my tail." My mother turns beet red, and she picks up her pace, and she starts to walk to the back of the church. And then, just in case anybody's wondering, she yells out, "I already wiped Tom Jr. He's fine." My mom went down the 14 stairs in the back of the church, walked the length of the basement, locked herself into the bathroom, and did not come out the rest of the service. When my dad had pronounced the amen, he took me by the hand, and we went downstairs and joined them in complete humiliation. We stayed down in the basement while the church conducted the business meeting. It was touch and go. It was about 50-50. But then a missionary lady who attended the church, her name was Helen Gemberling. I learned later that all the kids called her Miss Gem. She taught Sunday school there. She stood up and gave an impassioned speech on behalf of my father. She said, "Well, he preaches an excellent sermon, and he's proven that his children are normal. And so I vote that we call him as our pastor." And that tipped the balance, and they voted to call my dad to be the pastor of Putney Bible Baptist Church.
Back with Tim Lowry with New Pastor. Can you remember a time it was hard for you to behave yourself in just the way you were expected to? Can you think of a time when you were trying to get it right and things just went wrong? And is there someone who reached out to you when you felt like things were going wrong and helped you feel seen? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, @byu.edu. We want to thank Bill Harley and Tim Lowry for sharing with us today. You've listened to their stories. Now it's time to share some of your own. From parenting tips to overcoming personal hardships, join Lisa Valentine Clark on the BYU Radio podcast, The Lisa Show, where she'll help you take a good look at life.